Kijai, Vrindavan Dhamma Kijai, Mathura Dhamma Kijai, Navadvip Mayapur Dhamma Kijai, Jagannath Puri Dhamma Kijai, Gangamayi Jamuna Devi Kijai, Bhakti Devi Kijai, Tulsi Maharani Kijai, Samaveta Bhakti Rinda Kijai, Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Tapasamam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Samsaja Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Saja Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So it's July 14th, 2010, in Radhadesh. We're reading from Canto 4, Chapter 28. We're going to read Text 45, Text 46, and 47, even though 45 and 46 actually are purports. And this is going to be about serving the form and the instructions of the spiritual master or advanced Vaishnavas. So text 45. Ajanati priyatmanam.
Ajanati priyatmanam.
Ajanati priyatamam.
Ajanati priyatamam.
Yadoparatamangana.
Yadoparatamangana.
Shustirasanamasajya.
Shustirasanamasajya.
Yata purvam upacharat.
Yata purvam upacharat.
Please chant.
Ajanati priyatamam.
Ajanati priyatamam. I was asked to speak more slowly. If I start speaking too fast, please just signal me. Just say, hey, slow down. But you got to tell me, otherwise I won't notice. Ajanati. Ajanati.
Without any knowledge.
Without any knowledge.
Priyatamam.
Priyatamam.
Her dearmost husband.
My dearmost husband.
Yada.
When
Upadatam passed away,
Angana,
the woman,
Sustira,
fixed up,
Asanam,
on the seat,
Asadhya, going up to, yata, as, purvam, before, upacharat,
went on serving him.
So what was the word here for her husband? Which Sanskrit word here meant her husband? Priyatma. One who's priya means very dear. So sometimes there's a misunderstanding that in devotees' family relationships, there should not be any affection. Right? That was that. We had someone write an article for Back to Godhead recently, submit an article in which she talked about the fact that there should be affection in the family. And some of the editors said that if we print this, people will think, why do they even need to say this? What kind of a society is it where you need to say, you need to have affection for your family members? But there was a time in ISKCON when people were preaching like that. And unfortunately, when that's done at one point, then it sometimes continues. And there's certainly still a strand of people who think that being detached from the world means that you have no affection, as Rasmandala Prabhu pointed out. Actually, the reverse is the opposite, that your affection expands. Instead of only having affection for your family members, you have affection for everyone. And in fact, when Lord Brahma sees all of the Vishnu forms, when the cows and the calves rather, and the cowherd boys all manifest as Lord Vishnu, it's said that each manifestation of the Lord was glancing on the devotees with affection. And the acharyas explain, and Srila Prabhupada explains, that's the last thing that he translated and commentated on before he left this world, that this affection is the original form of passion. So if we want to conquer lust and its younger brother of anger, the way to do that is to develop affection. That is the key, not to simply stop lust and anger. That doesn't work. If you try to stop lust, you become angry, right? Or you become cold-hearted. So here the term, these two are great devotees, King Malayadwaj and his wife Madhurikshana. They're both great devotees of the Lord, and she's feeling much affection. Her husband is the Priyatman, okay? Prabhupada's translation and purport. The daughter of King Vidarbha continued as usual to serve her husband, who was seated in a steady posture, until she could ascertain that he had passed away from the body. So he was so still that she couldn't tell if he was alive or dead. You remember I told the story the other day of the devotee who left his body in the Soviet labor camp, right? In Siberia. And how his cellmate described that when he came back to the room, he thought the devotee was still alive. He was talking to him. Oh, why aren't you chanting anymore? And then when he touched him, the body fell over. Purport. It appears that the queen did not even talk to her husband while serving. She would simply perform her prescribed duties without talk. Thus, she did not stop rendering service until she could ascertain that her husband had passed from the body. So again, we should understand that this is in the vanaprastha stage, that although husband and wife can stay together in the vanaprastha stage, they can either stay together or stay separately, as Krishna explains in the 11th canto. If they do stay together, it is no longer with a sexual relationship, not only gross, but not even subtle. And here is so extreme that they were not even having any conversation. The husband was just in a mystic trance. If you know the stages in Astanga Yoga, you know the stages? The eight stages of Astanga means eight. What are they? Anybody know? Yam-niyam. So first you have to give up your sinful activities like meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling. And you also have to take up proper activities. In other words, you have to become a nice person. Next step, what are the next two? Pranayama. Pranayama and asana.
pranayama and asana. So the asana is stilling the body, and the pranayama is stilling the wind body. Actually, we're covered by seven layers. The soul is covered by seven layers, according to Ayurveda. The coverings of the body can be described in various ways. Am I speaking slowly enough now? Can you understand me? Yes? No? Yes? No?
Yes.
Hello? Yes? Okay. So you can say we just have a subtle body and then a gross body, but you can also describe various layers of covering. So one covering over the soul is a covering of air, the different kinds of prana in the body. So the pranayama makes the air still, as Krishna explains in the fourth chapter. You offer the ingoing breath into the outgoing as a sacrifice and you remain in trance. And the asana stills the body. So by doing this pranayama and asana, you can come to the next level, which is?
Dhyana
and? Dhanani. So your meditation, you start meditating and you're supposed to meditate on? Vishnu, in the heart. Ishvara Sarvabhuta Namritesha Arjunatisthati. Krishna says you bring the life air between the eyebrows and you meditate on the Lord in the heart. And then? Samadhi is the end. Prachadhara. Prachadhara means that your senses are withdrawn from their objects. We all experience mechanical prachadara during deep sleep. Just like you started falling asleep right now, right? And when you fell asleep, you lost awareness of the room, correct? Right? Yes. When you sleep, you lose your awareness of the room. You lose your awareness of the sense objects. The senses stop. One problem with my speaking slowly, it's not as lively, and it's harder to stay awake, so I can speak fast, and you all stay awake, but many of you who have English as a second language will not understand me, or I can sleep more slowly, so you can understand me, but then you'll fall asleep. These are the choices. Okay. Sorry. So you cannot enter into samadhi, which is the deepest stage of meditation, as long as your senses are engaged with their objects, because the mind is then following the senses. Oh, look at that. What about this? Let me hear that. What does this feel like in your... Right? Chanchalahimana Krishna. When Krishna gives this system of yoga, Arjuna says, I can't do prachadhara and samadhi because my mind is going everywhere. I can't fix it. So in this, we see that this king, Malayadwaj, had perfected this science, and all of his senses were withdrawn from their objects. He wasn't responding anymore to the world. And therefore, and also a person in that state, their heartbeat goes down, their breathing goes down. There are even people in the modern age who can do this. And there's been scientific experiments. The very accomplished mystic yogis can go into a cataleptic trance, where they appear to be dead. And some of them can stay that way for up to 3 weeks. I think that's the longest that a modern yogi, at least that has been a scientific experiment done on. There may be others in the Himalayas upon whom no experiment has been done. There was a very famous mystic yogi, a German mystic yogi, called Wolf Messing. If any of you have heard of him, if you haven't, very interesting fellow. And he lived during the Nazi regime, and he was from a Jewish family, so he left Germany and took shelter in Russia. Stalin gave him shelter because Stalin thought that he would be possibly a military weapon. Seriously. Well, he had the mystic power of controlling other people's minds. And Stalin gave him two tests. One was to rob a bank without weapons. So he went into a bank, handed the banker a note, and the banker looked at the note and thought it was an authorization to turn over 100,000 rubles from the head of the bank. It was just a blank piece of paper, and he handed Wolf Messing the 100,000 rubles. That was one test. The other test was Stalin put him in his private quarters and said, now you get out. You walk out the door, and the guards all had strict orders not to let him pass. And as he walked out, he simply told all of them mentally, I am the head of the KGB. I am the head of the KGB. Which he didn't look anything like the head of the KGB. And as he walked past, oh, there's the head of the KGB. And he walked out of the door. Anyway, he could also go into a cataleptic trance. He could do that for 3 days. And when he was a young man, that was how he earned his living. He worked for a wax museum, and he would go into a cataleptic trance for 3 days, and they would put him as one of the exhibits. And that was how he made his money. So even today, there are people who are able to go into pratyahara and withdraw their senses so that it's very, very difficult to tell if they are alive or dead. So this was the situation with King Malayadwaj. Of course, this state is also achieved by loving ecstasy. So even materially speaking, if you're in love with someone, I don't know if all of you here have ever been in love, but if you've ever fallen in love with someone, you think about them such that you forget everything else, at least for a while. You're sitting in school and the teacher's talking and you're not really there. You're just thinking about whoever you love. Or any attachment. Prabhupada says we all have a shakti, we all have attachment. So many of you here may not be hearing anything I say. I don't know how many of you here are not really here. You may be someplace else. You may be thinking about, okay, I hope she stops on time because I have all these things to do and see what do I have to do. I have to write this email and I have to talk to this person. I have to go to the bank. We're thinking about our attachments, and if we deeply enough think about our attachments, we lose awareness. What did you say again? Huh? What was that? You don't see anything, you don't hear anything, you don't feel anything. You're somewhere else. And of course, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu showed an example of this deep pratyahara and samadhi, not from practicing mystic yoga, but from love. When he entered the temple of Jagannath, he fainted and went into this pratyahara and samadhi. Everyone thought he was dead. And they weren't sure if he was alive or dead. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya came, put a little cotton by his nose, and it moved slightly. So he said, ah, he's in trance. And he took him back to his home. So we are not advised at the present time, or even in general, the process of mystic yoga is not as sure as the process of bhakti. And it has dangers. Of course, there are some dangers in bhakti. One of the anarthas are the weeds that are produced by bhakti, where people say, oh, you're such a wonderful religious person, and you think, yes, by bhakti, I have become prestigious and powerful in the world. But the harms coming from mystic yoga are much more dangerous. From mystic yoga, you can really think you're God. And there are many people even today who play around with mystic yoga and kundalini yoga and think that they're God. I've met them. They write things on the internet. You are God. And also, this process of mystic yoga or kundalini yoga, it's only for people who have tremendous mental and intellectual strength. And I don't mean like scholarly strength. I know one Gurukuli who was born, he was a natural mystic yogi. He naturally could do all of these things in mystic yoga from a previous life. And he told me, he said, don't ever advise anyone to take this path. He said, for most people, it's like giving a chainsaw. You know what a chainsaw is? You cut down trees with it, you like pull a string, and it's this long oval with a chain around it, and it cuts down the trees. And, you know, those things have a kickback. He said it's like giving a chainsaw to a 3-year-old child. And many of the people who fool around with this kundalini and mystic yoga become physically ill. Now, this devotee told me that he's counseled many devotees who had fooled around with this before coming to Krishna consciousness. And many of them had very serious physical ailments, and some of them had very serious mental problems. It changes your whole
subtle and gross physiology. And there are many so-called spiritual masters who are able to awaken the kundalini in another person just by touching them or something like that. It's called Shaktipat Diksha. And the people get some rush of the kundalini and some feeling of, oh, now I have some spiritual realization. But it's awakened something that the person is not mature enough to manage. And then they have to go the rest of their life with various physical and mental problems, and they're not able to put it back. You can't really put it back in the box once you open it. So this is not, we're not advised to follow this system. Okay, we want to text 46. While she was serving her husband by massaging his legs, she could feel that his feet were no longer warm and could thus understand that he had already passed from the body. She felt great anxiety upon being left alone, bereft of her husband's company. She felt exactly as a deer feels upon being separated from its mate. Purport. As soon as the circulation of blood and air within the body stops, it is to be understood that the soul within the body has left. The stoppage of the blood circulation is perceived when the hands and feet lose heat. One tests whether a body is alive or not by feeling the heart's palpitations and the coldness of the feet and hands. So it's the point here is that she took some steps to ascertain, again, that she wasn't able to tell in any other way because her husband had stopped interacting with the external world. Okay, text 47. Being now alone and a widow in that forest, the daughter of Vidarbha began to lament, incessantly shedding tears which soaked her breasts and crying very loudly. Purport. Figuratively, the queen is supposed to be the disciple of the king. Remember, this is all part of a figurative story of King Puranjana. Sometimes devotees think that no fiction is allowed, that we should never read fiction, and we should only read non-fiction. However, there is a lot of non-fiction that is full of falsity. If you were to read the biography of some degraded person, today so many of the leaders of society are degraded persons. If you read their biography, it might be non-fiction, but it would be full of falsity. And yet there's many examples in the Shastra of fiction that are full of truth. So this is the story of Puranjana and King Malayadwaja and Madarikshana, the daughter of the king of Vidarbha, Vidarbhi or Madarikshana, is a fictional story, but it's full of truth. It's an allegorical story. One of the greatest tools in teaching others is to use allegory. Do you know why? Now we have someone else going into mechanical prachidara in the room. Yes?
Because we are thinking it's happening to someone else.
Yes. Exactly. If I tell you a story, then it's not about you anymore. It's about the people in the story. And so I can say all kinds of heavy things about you, and you just nod and smile. It's also interesting because it does go directly to the conscious awareness. You might think, well, it will only affect me if I know it's about me. No, it's not a fact. It actually will affect you more. You let down your defenses. Also, when you tell stories, there's scientific experiments that when you tell stories, you go into a kind of trance. Your brain goes into alpha waves. You go into a light hypnotic trance. And it actually goes deeper into the consciousness, the art of storytelling. So we're thinking if we do an education degree, that one of our modules will be on the art of storytelling and using so many examples from the scripture of both fictional and non-fictional stories. So figuratively, the queen is supposed to be the disciple of the king. Thus, when the mortal body of the spiritual master expires, his disciple should cry exactly as the queen cries when the king leaves his body. However, the disciple and the spiritual master are never separated because the spiritual master always keeps company with the disciple as long as the disciple follows strictly the instructions of the spiritual master. This is called the association of vani, words. Physical presence is called vapu. As long as the spiritual master is physically present,
The disciple should serve the physical body of the spiritual master. And when the spiritual master is no longer physically existing, the disciple should serve the instructions of the spiritual master. This does not imply that when the spiritual master is personally present, that you don't serve his instructions. That was not what's implied there. So sometimes it may seem to us that Krishna consciousness, that full realization of bhakti, is very far away. Like the Ishvarupanishad says, God is near and he is also very far. Or as our Bhakti George Harrison Harisan sang, right? It takes so long. Right? You all remember his song, My Sweet Lord. It takes so long. He said, I'm going to show you it won't take long. Right? You remember that? So it may seem like that. Oh, Krishna's very far away. He's not, he's not accessible. Now, of course, Krishna's far away because Bahirmukha, we have turned our face away from him. He's not really far away. Just like if you have a good friend whom you have cheated, or if somebody has cheated you, maybe in our life we can think of somebody who we thought was a friend, who we thought we could trust, we had a nice relationship with them, and then they harmed us in some way. They cheated us, they lied to us, they stole from us, they misused the relationship. And we may still feel affection for that person, but we no longer want to intimately associate with them because we know that they're not our well-wisher. So if such a person wants to again associate with us, are we going to, if they knock on our door or email us, are we going to immediately say, oh yes, thank you for coming back? Will we? No. Satchinandan Maharaj has one essay where he writes, or poem, I think, where he says, Krishna, don't trust me. And that's our situation. We're not, we've proved that we're not trustworthy. We've been having an illicit affair with Maya Devi for a very, very, very long time. So therefore, Krishna doesn't immediately say, okay, great, come back. So how do you do that then? If you've hurt somebody, you've offended somebody, you've harmed somebody, and they're not really willing to just say immediately, okay, let's be friends again, how would you reestablish a relationship? How would you prove it? If they won't let you in, how will you prove it? How will you have an opportunity? You can sit on their doorstep. There's actually a story like that from one European monastery. I forget the details. You know, in those days they were very strict. If one of the monks had a relationship with a woman, then he wasn't allowed to stay there anymore. So one of their young monks had left the monastery. In those days, the monasteries used to be the hotels and the restaurants. Prabhupada talks about this. In India, the temples were the hotels. There were no hotels and restaurants other than temples. And that was one way that the temples and monasteries made an income. And then travelers could get spiritual benefit by staying at the church or the temple or the monastery. So one time in this monastery, a family with a young, beautiful daughter stayed in their quarters, and one of the monks became attracted to her and left the monastery and went to that village. And after some time, because in those days the monks would take initial vows and then they would take lifetime vows later. And he thought, I've already taken my beginning vows. I can't be with this woman. Let me go back. So he came back to the monastery and he talked to the head. And the head said, I'm happy to let you back, but the other brothers are not going to be so open. He said, you'll have to wait outside the door until there's an agreement of all of the brothers that we will let you back in. So he waited outside the door, and the head of the monastery, it was winter time, the head of the monastery gave him a cloak. And a couple times some of the brothers would come and give him some bowl of soup or something like that. But basically he was just sitting outside the gates for 3 days and three nights in the snow and the wind and the rain. And a few times during the day he'd knock on the door. And eventually, after 3 days, first day they said, no, we don't want to let him back in. He's already, you know, broken his vows, he's left, why should we trust him? And only when he showed his determination by sitting for 3 days in the cold and the wind and the snow did they let him back in. So yes, certainly that is there. In the story of Rikasura, Prabhupada said, the mercy shown to the tried devotee, his Brahman, very great, Shukshma, very fine, that Krishna actually gives himself to the tried devotee. So that is certainly there. And how else do we get entrance? Just like this monk, how did he, what was his other thing? Besides just sitting on the door, he did what? Yeah.
Third person.
There was a third person. The head of the monastery was on his side. You go through a friend. If somebody who you do trust comes to you and says, you know this person who offended you, they want to change. For my sake. And even this is how most people get their jobs. Most people get their jobs through a friend. Somebody recommends them. Oh, I know this person. They're very good. That's often how people sell a house, so many things. So we go through one of Krishna's good friends. It's explained in the Madhurya Kadambini that Krishna is neutral. But the devotees, they go out and preach. They're not neutral. They're offering. Krishna's just like, whenever you want it, you can ask me for it. And the devotee is like, here, take it. When Lord Nityananda takes the view of a devotee, he says he's banging on the doors, saying, purchase me, please. They're begging. Mahatseva dwara vimuke. If you serve the great souls, it opens the door to liberation. Therefore, to achieve Krishna without the blessings of the devotees, we can say it's impossible. Maybe possible in some cases, but we can say impossible. Therefore, Jesus said, you cannot come to the Father but through me. You can't come to the Lord without going through a devotee. You can't. You can't do it. And also, it shows Krishna that we care. If I really care about you, I'll be nice to your children and your family members. I can't say, well, I want to have friendship with you, but not with anybody that you love. Right? Love me, love my dog. So how do we get this relationship? One is by vapu. One is by serving the body of the mahat. By doing physical service. Like this Madhurekshana, she's massaging his feet. She's bringing him water, washing his clothes. You're doing service on the physical platform, as Prabhupada says here, for the mortal body. And we have the example of Kalidas. What's his name? Kalidas or Krishnadas? His name is Kalidas. He was an uncle of Raghunath Das Goswami. He lived in Bengal, and he would get the food remnants of every devotee in Bengal. What he would do was he would give them something to eat, and then he would take whatever they had left. And one time he did this with a devotee, all the castes, but there's one specific story told when he went to a devotee who was born in a lower caste, Janu Thakur, and he gave them some mangoes, and he said, I'd like your remnants. And Janu Thakur said, no, you're an exalted person and I'm lowborn. How can you eat my remnants? And he said, well, it says in the Shastra that if one is a devotee of Krishna, the material circumstances are irrelevant. Where you're born, what your caste is, that doesn't matter anymore, anything. Whether you're tall or short or skinny or fat or old or young or brown or white or pink or whatever. And Janu Thakur said, that's true. The Shastra is correct. But that doesn't apply to me because I'm not a devotee. So
What could Kalidas do? He went off to the side and waited, and he saw as Janatakura walked back into the house, his footprints were visible in the ground. And Kalidas took the sand from the footprints and put it on his body. It says Janatakura offered the mangoes to Krishna, then he sat down and ate, and then his wife ate what was left, and then she took the leftover seeds and skin, wrapped it in some leaves and threw it in a ditch. And Kalidas went and he sucked on them. And because of that, when he went to Jagannath Puri, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu had a rule that nobody could drink the water from washing his feet. There was a ditch by the temple where he'd wash his feet. Nobody was allowed to drink his foot bathing water. And Kalidas, when he came, he put his hands under Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's feet. 3 times he drank. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went back to his room, he told his servant Govinda, "You give this man the remnants of my food." So because he had served the devotees, he got to serve God. To get the water that washes the body of God, that is sweet. Charanamrita. Amrita is nectar. Amrit. Drit means to die. It gives you freedom from death. Frees you from all misconceptions. And to have the food that Krishna has eaten, just like every day we're offering our food. Anything that Krishna has touched. So he got the supreme, ultimate perfection of life from serving the devotee. And there it's mentioned that 3 things are very powerful. The foot dust, the foot bathing water, and the food remnants. And if you think about it, these things are generally, materially speaking, how do we say this? Disgusting. Right? Can I be frank? So to take the dirt that's on the bottom of somebody's feet, or to take the water that's washed the dirt off of somebody's feet, would you drink somebody's bath water? That's revolting. Unsanitary, be reported to the health office. If we had some general custom like that, that we all washed each other's feet and drank the water, we'd be reported. Or eating the food that somebody's eaten? You know, mothers do that with their babies, but generally, if somebody's eaten from something and their saliva's on it, we don't eat it. That's how our mommies and daddies trained us, right? You know, pick up something someone else has eaten and eaten from it, you'll get germs. So just like when my father asked Prabhupada, why do we distribute prasadam, and Prabhupada said, you believe in infection. He said, if you eat the food that a sick man has eaten, you'll get their disease, and if you eat the food that Krishna's eaten, you'll get Krishna's disease. You'll become transcendentally realized. So the great souls, Mahatmanas Tuman Partha Daivim Prakriti Mashritaha, those who've taken shelter of Radharani, their bodies have a spiritual effect. Like an iron rod put in a fire has the same effect as fire, although it's iron. It acts like fire. So when one becomes fully self-realized and fully Krishna conscious, then their body also has, everything that touches their body has a transcendental effect. And how pleasing that is to Krishna, that you're willing to do humble service for his devotee. Not just service, but humble service. And if we think about the service for the form and the following of the instructions, we'll see that the common thread is humility. To follow someone else's instructions in the modern day is almost impossible. I asked one of our gurus in ISKCON, how many disciples do you have? He says, 4, my 2 arms and 2 legs. He says, if you ask me how many people I've initiated, that's about 600. And we see that people will say, yes, yes, I'm your disciple. Okay, please do this. No, I don't want to. Even if it's a small thing from our perspective, please do this. I've talked to so many people in positions of guidance and spiritual master
in the movement, and they all say exactly the same thing. Very difficult to say to someone, do this, even a small thing. What to speak of if you say, if you actually cut the false ego? One disciple of Radhana Swami told me, said in his classes he'll be very cutting, but when he deals one-on-one, he said only maybe with 5 people. Otherwise, just soft. Because people won't do it. So to serve the body of the great soul requires a lot of humility. Especially to take things like foot dust and food remnants. And to follow the instructions of the great soul requires a lot of humility. To really follow. To follow externally doesn't require much. Even that is something in this day and age. To go in public with tilak and shaved head and dhoti is a huge tapasya at the present time. You become quite different from the world, right? We were going into town and Jai Krishnaprabhu was telling me that the tourist office still tells people not to come here. Oh, they're weird. But to really follow the instructions of Srila Prabhupada, of Narada Muni, how many times do we hear Prabhupada speaking in a lecture or read a purport and go, whoa, do I really have to do that? It can feel as revolting as, you know, taking some of the dirt from somebody's feet. How can I do that? But this humility is the door between anishta sadhana bhakti and nishta sadhana bhakti. If we feel that Krishna consciousness is sometimes, as Prabhupada says, a hard struggle with determination, then that means we are not yet on the platform of nishta. And the door, according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Bhajana Rahasya, where he correlates the steps of Krishna consciousness with the Shikshastaka. What happens when most of the anarthas are destroyed? Nasta prayashu bhadreshu nityam bhagavata sevaya bhagavati uttama shloke bhakti bhavati nashtaki, is that you achieve humility. What does that mean? It means when most of the anarthas are destroyed, my false ego, at least 50%, sometimes Prabhupada says, sometimes he says 75%. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between, and Madhurya Kanambadi seems to indicate about 40%. So somewhere between 40 to 75% of the false ego is scrubbed away. Well, what's there? Jeto Darpana Marjanam. Darpana, mirror, Marjana has become clean. And what do you see in the mirror then? Your real self. And when we see our real self, guess how we feel? Humble. And contrary to materialistic propaganda, humility is very nice. Maya is constantly telling us, don't do this humility thing. Pretend to do the humility thing, that's okay. But don't do the real humility thing now, it'll hurt. Lots and lots of pretend humility. Oh, I'm so fallen. I'm so bad. Everything I do is bad. I'll never do anything in life. Oh, I don't know anything. I'm useless. Do lots of that, but don't get real humility. But real humility is really, 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 really sweet. So this service of the great souls, either Vapu or Vani, when done with genuine humility and to provoke genuine humility, opens the door to our Krishna consciousness. And that will bring us very easily to not only these states of pratyadhara and samadhi that the mystic yogis achieve with much trouble and risk, but far beyond that. Prabhupada says that this mechanical state of samadhi is not the ultimate samadhi. The ultimate samadhi is when Krishna appears within the heart, when Krishna manifests of his own will within the heart, beyond the stages of the mind and the intelligence. And that is only there when he trusts us. Right? When he trusts us. And that trust will be there if we develop this humility in the service of the great soul. So I've gone 7 minutes over, for which I apologize. And I'm leaving early tomorrow morning. Thank you very much for having me here. I always like coming to Radhadesh. So I'm ending the class now. The class is officially ended now. I will sit here for another 7 minutes and answer questions, but the class is over. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Anybody can leave now and it's okay, the class is over. No need to stay. Yes?
You're talking about the beginning, I mean, you're describing the beginning of the class about the queen and the king, about the beginning of the it's fun, as you say, of Merida. So, and then you're saying that in, also that in this class sometimes that there's a lack of affection between husband and wife, that's being preached. So, it seems like you're trying to come from the vanity straight away, but what happens in when people get married and they're trying to run?
Okay, well, you're saying that you think that the ISKCON preaching that there shouldn't be affection in marriage life is people trying to become vanaprastas right away. I'd say two things. First of all, the couple here are vanaprastas, and they have affection for each other. What's happened is their affection has, it's now genuine affection. It's no longer lust. The original form of lust is affection, according to Prabhupada's purport in 10th Canto, Chapter 13. I don't remember the specific verse number. Its original form of lust is affection. If you want to conquer lust, you have to have affection. And one of the many purposes of the Grihastha Ashram is to help a person to do that. If you can do it without going through the Grihastha Ashram, that's also okay. In fact, that's preferable if you can actually do it. If you can, you know, but that's the general method for doing that. Not just Grihastha, but the Grihastha Ashram. That's its purpose. To turn the lust back into its original form of affection. So if you say they want to jump to the Vanaprastha Ashram, very nice. If somebody can really do that. You can go directly from brahmachari to grihastha, or directly from brahmachari to vanaprastha, or directly from brahmachari to sannyas. If you can go directly from brahmachari to grihastha, to vanaprastha, and be at the stage of actual affection, without lust, very nice. But that's not usually what people do. They think the way to conquer lust is to shoot it. You can't. This is another class. So I will just simply say, you can read Bhagavatam 5.25.5, and you can read Madhulila 8.138 to see why you cannot kill lust. You can't. Impossible. If you try to kill it, what will happen? There's several options that will happen. Kill it, deny it, hate it, beat it up. What happens if you try to kill it, hate it, deny it, and beat it up?
It fights back.
Oh, it fights back. It gets stronger. Have you ever noticed that with material desires in general? That if you fight them, deny them, shoot them, beat them up, they get stronger? Have you noticed that? There's a science as to why that happens. You're meditating on that. What else can happen?
It dies.
No, they don't die. You can't kill it, my dear friend. There's a reason why you can't kill it. You can become stone-hearted. You can become temporarily stone-hearted. So that you feel nothing. Is that nice? Generally, the stone-heartedness doesn't last. Periodically, you'll get what? Stone-hearted people periodically get angry. Anger is the younger brother of lust. So if you try to kill lust, deny it, beat it up, destroy it, you will become angry, or you're stone-hearted, or your lust will flare up like some huge fire and devour you at some point. And we've seen this happen to many, 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 many people. No, I don't have any lust. And the next thing they know, they're running off with somebody. Or they're yelling at everybody, and they think their service is to criticize all the leaders in the Hare Krishna movement. I met one person who told me, my service to Prabhupada is to destroy ISKCON. I'm like, okay. So this is... You know, I actually said that to him. So it comes out as stone-heartedness, anger, or uncontrollable lust. How do you conquer lust? Come on. Got to turn it back into its original form. You can't kill it. The reason you can't kill it is because its original form is part of the soul. If you don't believe me, go read those two verses and purports. Part of the soul. Prema is part of the soul. What we call lust in this world is sick prema.
Burning.
Okay.
Where do we find in the series of the verses preceding this verse, from which verses we can conclude that King Malayabhat was affectionate towards his wife? That's one question.
Okay.
And
I don't know if I could do that without some research.
Okay, it's in the context also of Bhagavad Gita verse in which I guess it's in the series of the verses. Where Krishna explains the items of knowledge.
Of knowledge, 13, 8 through 12.
Yes, so there is
detachment from wife, children, home, and the rest.
Right. So then, yes, they also know the story about Shiva and the Sena and you know, children being cursed to die and all these things. So, I mean, how do you put all these things in context? It appears to me that it is, according to Shastra, whatever you can see, it's more than appropriate for wife to be affectionate or serve. Devotion, even worship husband, it is fit for it, naturally. Whereas I don't find in the Shastra, at least so far, I didn't find places where men is advised to be affectionate for his wife.
I'd have to go back here and look carefully. I think I made a mistake. I think Madhuriksha is their daughter, not another name for her. Well, I'm not sure. I'd have to look again. Garva, impotent. I always thought that was her name. The daughter of King Bhadarva, in the house of the king. Yeah, I think that was their daughter. Well, I don't see how you can protect somebody without being affectionate to them. Is that possible? I mean, Prabhupada says in the purport to in 13.8.12, he says this does not mean that one should not have affection for wife and children. They're natural objects of affection.
He says they are natural objects of affection. The first part,
I could look this up for you.
Yeah.
And I don't have it right here.
Yeah,
but I know that there's many places where Prabhupada talks about expanding the affection, not cutting it off. The problem is more when you think the problem is not affection. The problem is when you think this wife is my object of enjoyment, and that's not affection. That's something very different.
I can very much
That's something radically different.
Yeah.
I mean, even the woman is advised not to think of the man like that. Lord Kapila Dev says that if a woman thinks that the husband is the source of all of her wealth, her sons, then it's like the singing of the hunter for the deer. So, affection is different. I mean, according to that verse in purport in 10:13, affection is the original form of lust. Lust is something very different. And if you think that someone is your enjoyable object, you can't really have affection because you're not seeing them as a person. They're an object. It's like anamoya. The advice for the man is don't become under the control of the woman. I can't do this in 1 minute. Is that all right?
Yeah, I don't mind.
Is that okay?
I'm
going to have to say some things here that may not be very pleasant. So if you don't want to hear them, you can go. Anybody who wants to go, any of the ladies especially, you can just go now because this may hurt a little bit. So
We have this body according to our desires in a previous life and our use of how we used our freedom. So the soul that gets a woman's body is a soul that misused their freedom more. And Prabhupada talks about how the woman's body is more under passion ignorance than the man's. That means the covering is thicker. The covering of the modes is thicker. Do keep in mind that you have to look at Varna. You have to compare Brahmin men and women and Kshatriya men and women. You can't look at a Brahmin woman and a Shudra man and say that. So it's not all men. We're not talking about all men and all women. But women in general, they're called stri. They expand material enjoyment. A woman's lust, I think of it like a fountain. Like a man's lust is very, tends to be very gross and explicit and concentrated and focused and obvious. Women's lust is not like that. I think of it like a fountain. If you push down on a fountain of water, the water goes everywhere. So women's lust is everywhere. It pervades everything that they do. Their clothing, their food, their talk, their everything that they do. It's everywhere. And the women have a general tendency to want to expand. You see this in a family. You know, I spend a lot of times with families. And it's usually the woman, usually, not always, usually the woman who says, I want a bigger house, I want a bigger car, I want more clothes, I want more things for the baby. I want, no, we're having a baby, and we have to have a bigger house. No, we have to have this, we have to have, think of several families where, you know, it's just, it's the woman who's, several families. You know, they had a nice little house, and as soon as the baby was there, now we need a bigger house. Now we need this, and now we need this, and now we need this, and now we need this. And men tend to expand in order to please the woman. Why do they want to please the woman? Why do they want to please the woman? Why do they want to please the woman? Do you all know why they want to please the woman? Come on. I'm not going to be too gross. I'm not going to be too gross up here on the Vyasa side. Why do they want to please the woman?
To enjoy sex
life. Subtle and gross. And they figure if they please her, she'll give them what they want. Why are, you know, the advertisements you see in the magazines? You know, the man's bringing his wife a diamond bracelet, and she goes, oh, thank you. Why do they want that? Because then she'll say, sure, I'll do what you want. Pretty simple. And then what happens? Then the man becomes controlled by his wife. That his wife can just say, do this. And he says, yes, yes, okay, sure. Now I want this, okay. Now I want this, okay. Now do this for me, okay. Now do this for me, okay. And then what happens to the poor man? What's going to happen to the poor man? That's what happened through this whole story of Paranjana here. What happens to the poor man? Then he's misusing his freedom. Man has more freedom. When lust is grosser, by the way, you have more freedom to deal with it. It's much harder for women to deal with lust. Much harder, because you don't even see it. A lot of women think, oh, I don't have any lust. You don't see it. How do you see something that's everywhere? For the man, it's so much easier. And women have some advantages. We have the advantage that we tend to be soft-hearted, which misuses sentimentality. And we have the advantage that we tend to follow, which if we follow a great soul is very good. Men don't like to follow, and they tend to be hard-hearted. So that's the disadvantage of having a male body. But the advantage of having a male body is you're less under the modes. If you come under the modes of a woman, guess what? Then you get to be a woman. It's not fun. Don't do it. Please don't do it. It really isn't fun. It really isn't. There's a lot more difficulty just built into the body and the mind. For a big chunk of our life, our minds are on a roller coaster. We have all kinds of bodily things that men don't have. And they don't stop, you know. You just trade one for another. You can have your menstruation or your pregnancy or menopause, you know. Fun. Really fun. Check it out. Don't do it. And then socially you're in a lower position. You can't do that because you're a woman. Even in ISKCON. Hare Krishna. We won't say much more about that. You know, in every society, you're held down more. You're exploited more. It's not fun. Don't do it. So the advice is don't come under the control of your wife for sense gratification. Don't do it. But affection?
You can't have exploitation of faith. They can't exist. Try it sometimes. Next time you feel angry, try feeling affectionate toward the object of your anger. Your anger will be gone like that. If you have lust, try feeling genuine affection. It'll be gone. They're incompatible. You can't have both. I said, you can't. Impossible. They're not the same. Affection means I see you as a soul. I see you as a person, like me, with feelings and desires. You're no longer an object for me to get something. And I can only do that if I first have my relationship with Krishna. I cannot possibly do that separate from Krishna. I can't first have genuine affection for people and then love. I can't. Prabhupada told my father that. Can't. Impossible. If you love Krishna, you'll love everyone except your wife. Says the devotee is Suridam Sarvadehinam. Sarva, all living entities. So that would be my strongest evidence. All living entities. Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmani Gavi Hasani Suni Chaivaspake Chai Pandita Samidharta. But not your wife and children. They're not, you know, they're not in the list. You can love the dog. I'm kind to the dog. Detachment is something very different. Detachment from children, wife, and home is detachment from thinking these are objects of my sense enjoyment for me to exploit for my own purposes, and my so-called affection with them is just a tool to get what I want. It's just business. In the 10th canto, when Krishna leaves the gopis and comes back, and they ask him indirectly, what kind of lover are you? They didn't want to be too angry with him because they really loved him, but they were really angry. I mean, they were really angry. What kind of lover are you? Some lovers exchange, you know, give back what they get, and some are ungrateful. And Krishna says those who are business, who just give what they get, are worse than those who have no love at all. So lust is business. Business where I try to get a profit. That's why profit, adoration, and distinction are subtle forms of lust. Lust means there's an exchange and I want to make a profit. We're exchanging something, but I want to get back a little more than what I gave, which is the source of all the conflict in married life, pretty much. That, you know, wait a minute, I'm not getting more than I gave. The other side said, I'm not getting more than I gave. Affection is something very different. It's very, very different. Affection comes from my heart's filled with Krishna. I love Krishna. If I love Krishna, I must love Lalita and Vishakha too. And I must love all living entities. I must love Mother Yasoda and Nanda Maharaj and the cows and the land and the Yamuna. Because they're all part of Krishna. They're all dear to Krishna. And I love all living entities. And then I'm full. And I'm not loving out of I'm empty and I want to get something from you. I'm loving that I'm full, I don't need you. See, as Krishna says, there's no need to depend on any other living being. He's no need to do his duty and there's no need to stop his duty. He's no personal need. The man that has no personal need to serve the wife, he's not serving the wife because he's hoping that she'll give him gross and subtle sex on him. That's no longer his motive. Why? He doesn't need it anymore. He's got prema, which is the original form of that. If you got the original form, what do you need the copy for? Right? Like you have original art here. One time we had a donor for our curriculum. It was for our school. We had a donor for the school. And I said, we can give you a gift. Oh, what gift is that? Well, we have a big print of a BBT picture. And he said, I'm very sorry. I only have original art in my house. If you have original art in your house, why would you want a poster? Imagine going to Mahaprabhu and saying, would you like a $5 poster of a painting? He'd laugh at you. So you have the real thing. You have the real prema. Why would you be interested in lust? Lust is like meat eating. You see the animal as an object to eat. Oh, what a nice cow. Let me eat it. You know, even the meat eaters are disgusted at people who eat, like, raw meat. Isn't that interesting? Have you noticed that? If you want to portray a really evil person in film or books, you know, have them lust over meat and eat raw meat, things like that. It's quite interesting. So it's like meat eating. And even if somebody says, well, I take very nice care of my cows before I kill them. I mean, that's better, right? Like Magrari the hunter, he half killed the animals, and Narada said, if you're going to kill them, just do it, you know, don't half kill them. So we'd rather people take nice care of their cows before they kill them than that they torture the cows their whole life. But obviously it's better. But does it have any deep meaning? So affection for somebody for whom you're lusting has no, that's not that kind of affection you should give them. Oh, my dear cow, I really like you. You're my friend. But why am I keeping you? To kill you. So that kind of affection, that one should be detached from that kind of affection. Oh, my dear wife, you're so beautiful. You're so this, you're so that. Just so that I can eat you. I don't think that's not what we want. Is that right? And there's danger both ways. There is danger both ways. The advantage of a woman becoming attached to a man is she can take birth as a man. But there's danger both ways. It's not that women should exploit men. It's not that the wife should see her husband as an exploitable object. Instead, she'll be miserable, first of all. But you don't get happiness that way. If we look at the examples, I think where we'd find this is in the examples and the shastra of the great devotees. I mean, I don't think we don't find examples of great devotees that were cruel to their wives and children, do we? I can't think of any. No?
No, but you see, if I recall properly, actually the way in which Puranjan became a woman was that he was overly
but attached for what?
Yeah,
of course, but attached for what? Attached means I feel empty because I'm not connected with Krishna, and I want you to fulfill my emptiness. It's like hunger. I'm hungry and I want to eat you. It's anamoya. That's what we mean by attachment. What we mean by material attachment, that's what we mean. No, you shouldn't have material attachment for anything. And the greatest material attachment is sex life. We have to give that up. How do you give that up? Maya shakta mana partha. Maya ashakta. Become attached to me, Krishna says. When we become attached to Krishna, even if we start by becoming attached to Krishna in the same way, Krishna will give me money, he'll give me liberation, he'll satisfy my curiosity. Even if I go to Krishna in the same way, as I start connecting with Krishna, then om purnamada purnamidam purnat purnamadachate. I become connected with the whole, then I become complete. No matter, even if my initial motivation was wrong, doesn't matter. I become connected, I start feeling complete, I start feeling satisfied. And then when I have attachment for Krishna and I'm satisfied with that, why would I want attachment for anything else? So it's not that first, it's exactly that first you give up attachment, and then that's the impersonalist idea. Which Krishna just says, don't do. What is it? 12.5. How does 12.5 start? Anyway, don't do it. Klesho dikatarashtesham avyakta shaktatesham. Avyakta hikatir dukam deha badbir vapite. Don't do that, he says. And Prabhupada says, don't do it that way. Don't say, okay, first I'm going to stop all my material attachment, and then when I'm pure, then I'll be able to love Krishna. That's not how it works. Just start loving Krishna. Start becoming attached to Krishna. And you start feeling, this is so nice. Why do I want to exploit my wife and children and my home and my money? I feel satisfied. And when I'm satisfied, then my love is on the platform of freedom. I'm loving my wife and my children, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says. He says, I see them as your servants. These are your servants, Krishna. And I'm taking care of them to please you. My wife is a devotee, and I'm taking care of her to please Krishna. My children are devotees. I'm taking care of them. Just like you have responsibilities here in this temple. aren't you supposed to care about the devotees you're responsible for? It's like Radha Gopinath has come to you and said, you know, what service do you want me to do, Lord? Okay, here are these specific jivas, I want you to take care of them. So that's what married life is supposed to be. The Krishna is saying, here's this jiva, please take care of them in my service. Oh, okay, my husband is a jiva that I'm supposed to take care of. He's Krishna's, he's not mine. He's not mine to exploit, and I don't need to exploit him. I'm full with Krishna, I don't need to exploit anybody. My children are jivas for me to take care of in Krishna's service. My home is Krishna's, and he's asking me to take care of it. It's like if I had a little child here and I had to go run to the toilet or something. I said, here, would you watch my child for me till I come back? Exactly like that. Krishna's saying, here, would you watch these jivas, please? Shouldn't you also like them? So the Shastra's warning against exploitation. And the main form that exploitation takes is a man wanting to exploit a woman. Basically, what it is that we think that I'm the Purusha. Ajyam Purana Purusham Naviyovanam Cha. Krishna's the Purusha. He's the enjoyer. I think I'm the enjoyer, and then what do I want to enjoy? I want to enjoy Prakriti. So the woman has a way of trying to enjoy Prakriti, and the man has a way of trying to enjoy Prakriti. When you're in a woman's body, you try to enjoy Prakriti by being Prakriti. You try to be Maya. Therefore, it's greater attachment. Greater attachment to want to be Maya than to have it. You want to be my baby. You want to walk down the street and everybody goes, whoa, I want that. That's how the woman tries to enjoy Prakriti. And the man tries to enjoy Prakriti by owning a woman. Owning a woman that supposedly is under his control, that he can enjoy when and how he wants. But as soon as you, what happens as soon as you try to be the Purusha of Prakriti? What happens when you try to be the owner of Prakriti?
You become Prakriti.
Well, if you really try to do it, yeah. You become owned by Prakriti. She's Krishna's servant. You can't own her. Too bad. She already has a master. And then you become her slave. That's all. The woman becomes a slave of her desire for furniture and clothing and food and children, and the man becomes a slave of the wife. And then you become degraded. So instead, Krishna's the Purusha, and I'm his Prakriti. Yeah. Perfect. And then I have affection for all living entities. What to speak of my family? I love everyone, except not you, because you're my kid. I mean, that's not... We used to do that sort of thing. People would do that. I love all living entities, but not you, because you're my child and I don't want any attachment. Like Queen Kunti saying, you know, let me give up my tie of affection. And Prabhupada says she wants to cut the bodily concept. In his lecture on that verse, he says one should have a relationship soul to soul via the super soul. Is that all right? I'm now going over. No, I'm now going past 9. Is that helpful? But there's a number of places where Prabhupada talks about the husband being affectionate to his wife and children. He talks about that the husband should protect his wife personally, just like you protect your wealth personally. I think that's also here in the 4th canto. So the wife should always remain on the chest of a good husband and be protected personally. You can't protect a wife unless you're kind to her. That's the shelter for a woman, is that my husband loves me and cares about me. That's her shelter. Her shelter is not really her home and her jewelry and her money. And her shelter is that somebody cares about me. So if you don't express some caring for a woman, you're not protecting her at all. She'll be miserable and she may run off with somebody else or whatever. I don't see how you can protect a woman without doing that. I don't see how you can protect anybody without doing that. If I said, please protect this cow, how can you protect the cow without being kind to the cow? Is it possible? I mean, we say we should even be kind to the cows and affectionate to the cows, and we talk about how if we're affectionate to the cows, they give more milk. Right? Sorry to go to these topics, but I was asked, and you all decided to stay, so, you know.
You can't blame me entirely. You can just blame me partially. Okay, I think I should end now. Thank you very much.